I'm Eric Zelo.
I'm Arthur Anderson.
And this past semester, we had an opportunity to do something really cool.
We had the chance to team teach a class with a bunch of students and get them out in the field doing some archaeology, get them down in the archives, doing some hands-on history, and explore a part of the history of our campus that had pretty well been forgotten, and something that even we were unaware of.
Yeah, it all began when I saw a picture, a photograph of what's now our main academic and administrative building, DeCary Hall. And there was this house in front of it, a house that's not there anymore.
Episode 3 continues the story of this little part of Biddeford, whose inhabitants have turned towards tourism and running shore dinner halls for early motorists and tourists here in vacation land. This episode's going to dig a little deeper into the family that was running the establishment we're thinking about and others nearby. The Mitchell family has deep roots in the Biddeford area, and we're kind of zooming in on this particular period of the 19th and early 20th centuries when some of the Mitchells, a branch of the Mitchells, were living at the house that we've been excavating and nearby.
And the Mitchell family is related to, as we mentioned in an earlier introduction to one of our earlier episodes, related to the Flood family, which has a shore dinner hall right next door. So part of this story is really about the dynamics between these two sides of the families and some of the tensions and stress that go along with that. The other thing that's really striking about these two families says something about this area, because they're both families with deep, deep roots. There's a whole series of families, if you look at early kind of 18th and 19th century maps, that own most of the houses in the area, and they're all marrying into one another and relating to one another and so on. And so the story of the whole area is a story of these different families. And that's something that starts to come out here, and something that for one, would like to explore in future classes, because it really strikes me as quite interesting.
Nice in situ doorway here, and then everything around it seems disturbed. Kind of back dooryard, and this is a shore dinner hall for a number of years. So I think we got someone's clam dinner from somewhere in the 19-teens. Got a little bit of a saucer come up over there, probably from the restaurant. So at least the restaurant era is coming to light a little bit.
From day one, we saw signs that a house had once sat on our dig site, with the discovery of a piece of window glass. On day two of the dig, someone found a few nails. Eventually, we were pulling all kinds of things out of the ground. Whole bricks, more glass and nails, stones with mortar on them, and even a pipe and a piece of a sink. One set of test pits found what was likely to be the doorway of the garage of the wayside.
The idea that this is cellar infilled with bulldozed rubble, it's hard to find another explanation.
Yeah.
So we're in the house.
While the story of the wayside is tied into the story of Biddeford as a whole, it's also the story of the Mitchell family. We were lucky enough to be able to interview two descendants of the family, Peter Thomas and Gloria Green, who you hear from throughout this episode. Our story of the Mitchells begins on April 1st of 1855, when 27-year-old fisherman Lorenzo Mitchell marries 26-year-old Miriam Lanfar.
So that's the fun of genealogy, when you you just imagine all these things. But anyway, it all happened because I just wanted to learn more about my mom's family. Unexpected stuff was meeting more cousins and people who had more information. I didn't expect that. That was really nice.
Lorenzo and Miriam have six children. Samuel in 1856, Alonzo in 1858, Thomas in 1861, Marietta in 1863, Abigail in 1867, and William in 1871. Our focus is on Alonzo, sometimes called Lon, and Abigail, known as Abby. According to census data from 1860, 1870, and 1880, the children all would have stayed home until sometime around the age of 5 or 6, and then gone to school until they were around 17. Alonzo, at the age of 21, is listed as a laborer in the 1880 census. That year, Lorenzo is appointed to a school agent position for District 6 of the city, and Alonzo is appointed as a special policeman.
What's a special policeman?
Special policemen were appointed by the city marshal when required, as on the occasion of conventions, celebrations, public exhibitions, church entertainments, and etc. They have, for the time being, the same authority as regular officers. They're basically temporary police officers for when help is needed.
On December 7th of 1881, Alonzo marries Sarah V. Sargent, but we don't have too many details about their marriage. In 1885, we have newspaper articles that suggest that Alonzo may have been working as a fisherman, probably with his father. We also have a reference of him as a fireman.
That's cool. I wonder what it would be like to fight fires back then.
Well, fireman meant something different back then. Peter explains it pretty well.
Well, he's listed as a fireman, but a fireman is the guy who fires the coal furnace, not the guy who rides around on the hook and ladder truck.
1885 is also the year when his mother deeded him the land where the wayside would be built. And in early 1886, the newspaper reports Alonzo Mitchell is putting the finishing touch upon his neat little cottage.
So it seems like the story of our building begins in 1886.
Well, there's actually a bit of a gap in the newspapers until 1889, where we see that Alonzo is a fireman at the Pepperell Mills.
We know that Alonzo is married, he has a house, he's had a couple different jobs, he's a well-respected fireman. What else do we know about him?
We know that he liked to go hunting at Biddeford Pool. He and Frank Cole, a possible cousin or second cousin by marriage, would often hunt waterfowl. There's a lot of mentions in the newspaper about how they would spend time in the pool, shooting or gunning. It seems like they were very successful.
In 1892, we had the first big legal case involving the family and the first family pet drama.
Warning, this one's about a dog. One newspaper called it a long, lively legal debate over a small dog's untimely end.
The gist of the case is that someone shot a small, black, and tan dog that belonged to Alonzo and his wife. From witness testimony that was published in newspapers, a group of young men from Biddeford were in the area to do some clamming and had brought their dog. Two of the boys, brothers Frank and Fred Doyle, had brought a gun with them as well. It sounds like the Mitchells' dog was following the group at some point, and when the other two guys, Nelson Norwood and Nat Tarbox, got to the beach, they heard a gunshot. Alonzo found the dog, wounded, near the road and brought it home to Sarah, who chloroformed it, presumably to stop its suffering. When the case was taken to court, Frank Doyle was found guilty of cruelty to animals and was forced to pay $5 in costs. In total, he ended up paying around $50, which is the equivalent of about $1,700 today.
At least they got some justice for the dog.
In 1893, Abby gets married to Roswell Flood and lives in Boston. This year, Alonzo runs as the Republican candidate for constable of Ward 1, and his brother William is running for ward clerk.
So I don't have anything about the Mitchells at all. I would think that the one thing I learned is that they were very hard workers. I just think they were very hard workers, and I think no one was a slouch. They worked hard.
Alonzo was the fireman for the city building until March of 1896, when he was replaced by George Levitt. Apparently, Alonzo was considered a first-class fireman and had a very thorough knowledge of steam.
Part of the reason for the change may have been monetary. Alonzo was being paid $2 a day for 7 days a week, the modern equivalent of around $75 a day or $526 a week, and George was only being paid $1.50 a day, around $56 a day, or just under $400 a week now.
In 1903, Abby returned to Biddeford, probably because her father wasn't doing too well. This is also the year that Alonzo marries his second wife, Rose A. Davis, who was a nurse. Rose had three children prior to marrying Alonzo, the youngest of whom lived with them.
Wait, isn't he already married?
Well, he was to Sarah, but at some point they got divorced. On the marriage record for Alonzo and Rose, it says that they were both married and previously divorced, but we're not sure when that happened.
In 1904, a family letter from Tom mentions a fight in the family saying, M should not have said what she did. Others should not have said things to provoke it. The affair is in the family, but let's bury it where it is. Later that year, Lorenzo passed away from tongue cancer at the age of 76. Now we've reached the second family pet drama, Pompey the Crow. The youngest Mitchell, William, aka Willie, enjoyed taming animals. Things like chipmunks, amphibians, reptiles, a seal named Lorelei that he'd feed mackerel, barn cats, and one baby crow that fell out of its nest, Pompey. Willie raised Pompey and taught him to speak.
This apparently included frequent curse words that he picked up.
Pompey had a knack for getting into trouble. He stole a keychain from Alonzo's wife, Rose, who chased him with a broom. In response, he later stomped around in some mud and walked along her clean laundry that was drying on a clothesline outside.
Alonzo apparently thought this was hilarious, especially since his wife had dumped some of his homebrew a few weeks earlier.
This is a big deal because, keep in mind, Maine had a total ban on the manufacture and sale of liquor starting in 1851 that didn't end until the national ban ended in 1934.
Unfortunately, his mischief would be his downfall. When Willie's mother Miriam found several dead baby chickens in their coop, she was confused. This happened four times before they caught Pompey in action, killing some newly hatched chicks. Miriam may not have been happy about it, but the chickens were more valuable to the family than the talking crow, so according to the story, reluctantly, she positioned Pompey's neck on the chopping block and grabbed the always well-sharpened kindling hatchet. Just as she raised it, Pompey grasped his bill in his talons, gave her a reproachful look, and muttered plaintively, "Poor Pompey."
Poor Pompey. Do we know when this happened?
Only that it was after Alonzo married Rose, and likely before Will was a part of a fishing fleet out of Gloucester, Massachusetts in 1909.
So, the story as you got it was written by my father, probably 1980-ish. I saw earlier versions, and then I actually read that at his memorial when he died. But it's a recent account. But if you look at the time frame, this is clearly a hand-me-down story, probably from Abigail, who would have been alive and experiencing the whole thing when her mother wrung her younger brother's crow's neck.
Sometime between 1906 and 1909, Abby starts flood shore dinners, also known as the Willows, in the house next to Alonzo's house. By 1909, Alonzo and Rose had also opened a shore dinner house, the Wayside Inn.
I wouldn't say entrepreneurial, but kind of entrepreneurial, if you think about it. Well, and even how about the women even getting involved? Yeah, that was pretty awesome.
What is a shore dinner house?
It's basically a seafood restaurant. In 1916, an article lists the menu as lobster stew, buttered clams, fried lobster, french fried potatoes, tomatoes, cucumbers, ice cream, cake, coffee, cigars. And another in 1918 says lobster stew, clams and butter, clam cakes, crab salad, plain lobster, fried lobsters, ice cream, and cake. They often had some lodging as well.
There's many articles in the newspapers about various groups from Biddeford and the surrounding areas visiting these two competing shore dinner halls.
So our next question is, growing up, did you hear any stories of the two shore dinner halls?
And this is the interesting part, and this is what I'm so fascinated with in terms of the stuff that you're dealing with, because the answer to that is no. I never heard about Alonzo's shore dinner. Surprised the heck out of me.
The next court case Alonzo is involved in begins with the city deciding to move the road to straighten it in 1911. But an old town cemetery is somewhat in the way. The city starts construction and, in the process, uncovers human remains. These remains seemingly go unnoticed by construction workers and are found by nearby residents, one of which was Alonzo. The city solicitor tried to bring proceedings against the men that found the remains because, according to some reports, some of them removed remains and took them to their homes. Many members of the community sued the city for the taking of pieces of their land to build this new stretch of road. In 1913, there appears to be a falling out in the family, with Miriam writing to Alonzo, "My son, Alonzo C. Mitchell, I gave you the land to build your house on, and your grandmother, my mother, gave you money to help you build it, and since your last marriage, you have taken and abused all privileges. Now I forbid you and your wife to trouble or trespass on your sister, Abby L. Flood, or any one of our family. Your mother, Miriam Landfar Mitchell."
It's not a loving, close-knit family from any way you look at it.
Business is apparently booming for both shore dinner halls, with customers coming in from all over the country, plus some from Canada. But in 1918, we had another court case, though in the end, less dramatic. A fish and game warden from Saco visited both Floods and Mitchells and issued violations for their lobster. However, the charges are almost immediately dismissed once they go to court. In 1923, it's believed that a gang of bootleggers threw a chain over electrical wires on Pool Road, knocking out the power around Alonzo's house.
There's some speculation that Alonzo may have been involved in rum running, but we haven't found anything that confirms this except for that he was homebrewing. It wasn't unnecessarily uncommon for people to homebrew and share with their friends during the Prohibition era, though.
In May of 1923, Alonzo and Abby's mother, Miriam, and Alonzo's wife, Rose, both died. However, both Shore Dinner Halls continued operations and seemed to do very well until they closed in the late 1920s to early 1930s. Alonzo died in a local hospital at the age of 86 in 1946. Abby lived until the age of 98, passing away in 1965. As far as we know, the two never spoke after the letter from Miriam in 1913.
Abigail Flood was my great-grandmother, and Alonzo Mitchell was her brother, so my great-great-uncle. The point that I wanted to, I think is important to realize, and I was just thinking about this in terms of family stories, is when it's not, part of it's the family association, the kinship network. But the question is, when was I associated with them? And so that gets you into something different, because Alonzo, I never knew. With Abigail, she didn't die until 1965, which is, I was probably 16 or 17 at that point. So I knew her as a kid growing up. But if you think about it, she died at the age, she was born in 1867. So when I knew her, she wasn't this vital lady that, you know, you guys are working on when she's running the Shore Diner and all of this is happening. Abby was a really quiet kind of person by the time I knew her. She could get kind of feisty. And, you know, from stories, you know, she was up to shenanigans early on, but was a good-hearted person. She didn't really talk mean about anybody. She liked her liquor. And it used to get kind of comical around, and this was a story, because it has to do with her sister, Marietta, who married a guy named Rankin over in Wells Beach and lived over there for most of her life. But anyway, younger years, Marietta was a teetotaler. So they'd have Christmas, but starting somewhere in early November, Abby would make a fruitcake. And then about once every other day, she'd take an eyedropper and poach a whole bunch of holes in the top of the cake and put in a dose of rum. So by the time Christmas came around, that cake was well loaded. And so that fruitcake became a really important thing to Marietta. She loved that fruitcake. Put a little whipped cream on the top. Well, she'd have one piece. And then, what would you like a second? Oh, yeah, yes, yes, of course. And so she had the second piece, at which point she proceeded to get up, go sit in the chair in the living room, and fall asleep for 2 or 3 hours because she wasn't used to the booze.
We never discussed that side of the family. And that was just the culture. I think these days people are a little more transparent, you know, about discussing stuff. And that wasn't the way it was then.
By the late 1930s, both Shore Dinner Halls had closed, both siblings had moved on, and both houses were sold to St. Francis College, which was beginning to spring up on what is now known as the UNE campus,